Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to today's talk. I'm Ina Cho, Correspondent Governor. So before we start, may I remind everyone to switch off their phones and anything that beeps. Now, we all know that weather is the safest topic in conversation, but perhaps not for the founding director of the Hong Kong Observatory, a combative and overly punctilious scientist who didn't think that it was his job to track typhoons. Please join me in welcoming Professor McKeown, a physicist and honorary professor at Hong Kong U, where he taught for many years, and also writer of a book which is available at the exit, Early China Coast Meteorology, The Role of Hong Kong, which was published in 2010 to much acclaim. And he is going to tell us the colourful history of the observatory's early days.
Okay. Thank you very much, Enid, for the kind introduction. Also, a word of thanks to Martin for suggesting that the topic might be of interest to an audience here. Perhaps a slight surprise to me. The book, as she mentioned, is first edition, still available at the front door. Nobody can talk about meteorology in the end of the 19th and early 20th century in this part of the world without encountering the personality of one August William de Burgh. He was the first founding director of the Hong Kong Observatory. He arrived here in the summer of 1883. He was a Dane, born in Copenhagen, to a cultured family. In his youth, he would have met the likes of Hans Christian Andersen and Søren Kierkegaard, who are regular visitors to the house. And his father was an artist, mostly in metalwork, but also in oils, as we see in this portrait of the young William around the age of 20, painted by his father. Excuse me. Could I have a glass of water? He had a PhD in astronomy, not a usual qualification in those days, and prior to coming to Hong Kong had spent 9 years at a private observatory in an Anglo-Irish family in the wilds of Sligo in the west of Ireland, near a small village called Coluny. In that observatory he did meteorological monitoring and especially pursued his interest in astronomy, something that he never lost. An interest, I should say, he never lost. And we have this remarkable photograph of him at the McCree Observatory, taken by a more distinguished fellow Dane, astronomer J.S.L. Dreyer, with the great refractor telescope at McCree. It was at one time the largest telescope in the world, but by the time he got there, out in the open, it was in pretty bad shape, and he really couldn't do an awful lot of useful work with it. His appointment was formally made by the Royal Society, or the Q Committee of the Royal Society, in charge of meteorology. And he was charged with two tasks in Hong Kong. The first of arranging for a time ball to be dropped to communicate the accurate time to the ships in harbour. And secondly, to monitor meteorological and geomagnetic data, as was done in many observatories throughout the world at the time. In particular, no mention was made of forecasting, a point he often made as soon as he got to Hong Kong. If he had taken a journey out to Puk Fu, he would have come across this great cemetery at a place called Kai Lung Wan or Kellet Bay, where Wafu Estate now stands. And it was raised to make room for Wafu Estate. It contains the remains of victims of a great typhoon of 1874. And as I said, it was raised, but the memorial stone, which I don't have a pointer for that, has been transferred to the Wauhop Sek Cemetery in the New Territories. This just to emphasize that typhoons were very much on the mind of people in Hong Kong at the time. This was just 9 years after the great typhoon of 1874. Some work had been done on typhoons in this part of the world prior to that. There's this remarkable chart of typhoon tracks in the South China Sea from a publication in Chinese by an American missionary, McGowan, 30 years earlier, published at Ningbo. This is the publication, The Navigator's Golden Needle. There was also published in Hong Kong just a year before his arrival, this pamphlet by one Henry Spencer Palmer. Palmer was an aide-de-camp to Governor Pope Hennessy and drew up a plan, a very detailed plan, for the first observatory in Hong Kong. But that was scuppered, ostensibly on grounds of economy, but in fact on political grounds, because of Palmer, as an associate of Pope Hennessy, being persona non grata in the colonial office in London. Why is that there? Excuse me. As soon as he got to Hong Kong, the observatory was not yet ready for occupation, and he was asked to visit stations along the China coast from which information might be derived relative to typhoons in Hong Kong. And indeed, he did. Was particularly asked to go to see Father de Chevron at Shanghai, Su Jia Hui Observatory, and to Manila, where there was another Jesuit observatory from which data on typhoons, a problem for Hong Kong, could readily be expected to be available. He did indeed go on a long trip, visited many lighthouses, went to the south of Taiwan, wrote a report when he came back. There was no mention of Father de Chevron or the Su Jia Hui Observatory, nor was there any mention of Manila. He certainly did not go to Manila. He went to Shanghai, of course, to see the customs stations there. This was the first manifestation of his hostility to the Jesuit observatories. He was not taken to task for this omission, but he would be taken to task on many occasions in the following 24 years. I've put a few of them up here, but I don't expect you to read them. Let me just point out one or two of them. This one from Governor Bowen to the Colonial Office in London within 3 months of his arrival here, saying, "My public duty compels me to state that all competent judges regard Dr. de Berk as an unfortunate selection on the part of the Colonial Office for that appointment." Let's pick out one or two others. Sorry. From the Acting Colonial Secretary in April 1890, "Your reply can only be regarded as evasive and unsatisfactory, and the officer administering the government," that means the acting governor, "views with regret your action." This is a formal chastisement, one of the very few he obtained in his time. But not many heads of government department got communications along these lines. Let me just look at one or two more. Again, from the Colonial Secretary in 1890, "If you were to confine your remarks to the questions put to you, it would, in His Excellency's opinion, be of advantage." And now, 6 months later, from the Colonial Secretary again, "If you do not feel equal to carrying out the duties of your office, His Excellency will be prepared to accept your resignation." Little chance of that. And let's just look at one last one shortly before his departure. A minute by the governor, acting governor May: "The language used by Dr. de Berk is calculated to shake one's confidence in his fitness to occupy the position he fills." This is just to give you an indication of the relations that would exist over a 24-year period between the head of department and the governor, the colonial secretary. Well, to study typhoons, of course, he needed to have information from many sources. So this slide just shows us the stations from which data could be expected. On the right-hand side here, the telegraph lines. There was an extensive Chinese telegraph system, but it was not very reliable. Often the messages didn't get through. There were a coastal telegraph system run by the foreign companies, and there was, of course, a very important connection to the Philippines, to Manila. But let me also point out this station, Bolinao, which is on the telegraph line linking Manila with Hong Kong. He put great emphasis on Bolinao. It was, in fact, not a meteorological station at all. It was a telegraph station run by the British Telegraph Company, but he had persuaded somebody there to do meteorological monitoring of the pressure, temperature, etc. And he always claimed that this data was superior to that provided by the priests in Manila. There is, of course, no evidence whatever for that. The priests were professional meteorologists. The telegraph for may have been very conscientious, but there was no reason to believe that that was the case. He always emphasized the data from Bolinao. One of his first things was to set up a storm warning signals. This is the earliest north-south storm coming from north-south, east or west, like that there. It wasn't. He talked about it as an invention, but of course it was something similar to what was used in Europe at the time. Some years later, there was a black set introduced to distinguish between storms at greater or lesser distance than 300 miles from here. Like that. And then later, 8-point warning system, storms from the north, northeast, east, etc. Over his dead body was this adopted. It was came, of course, from the priest at Xujiahui, and that meant it was beyond the pale. But the local Chamber of Commerce and the maritime community insisted that the observatory would have to use these signals, and he had to bow in the end. Well, having arranged storm warning signals, the next item was to warn, find a basis for warning with that. And even with only 2 years' data, in 1886, he already compiled a pamphlet on the law of storms in the Eastern Seas. It went to 4 editions. He claimed it was translated into many languages, including Japanese, although I have failed to find any of them. And he always sang its importance. We saw his altercations with the government and how he was often taken to task. He did, of course, have some reasons to be unhappy with the government, because for the first edition of this, the governor refused him any assistance whatever. He said, if you want to produce this, go ahead and do it on your own, in your own time and at your own expense. Similarly, for the second edition, he got no assistance from the government to produce this pamphlet. It was useful, I think, not as useful as he claimed it was. It mostly advice to sailors how to manage their ship in a storm. The latter two editions did get some support. He had some success in warning storms in the early years, although there was always a problem of communicating his warning to the public. He was in continuous conflict with the Spanish consulate in Hong Kong, who received independent warnings from the priests in Manila. And of course he had some reason to object to this, but the local community always put great faith in the signals from Manila. And he caused some confusion by not sending his warnings to the right locations to be distributed. In October 1890, a storm hit. Governor Davoy minuted yesterday evening my surprise that there had been no storm warning. My expectations as to the approach of a storm had become so assured that I ordered preparations for it. And the same was true of the boat community in the harbor. All the boats made headway for some shelter out there. The only warning went up after 6 o'clock in the evening when it was almost dark and invisible. And there was outrage, although there was not great damage. It was a big storm, but there was not great damage done by it. There was outrage in the local paper, especially the China Mail, at the incompetence of the observatory. And the governor was persuaded to set up a commission of inquiry as to what the value was of this department. He set up this commission, and its terms of reference included about 10 items, including this rather pointed item, whether the commission would recommend a continuance of the observatory with its existing or any other organization. A fortunate event, a coincidence occurred when this commission was sitting. Who should pass through Hong Kong on his way from Japan, where he was working for the Yokohama, now working for the Yokohama Water Authority, to England for vacation, than Henry Spencer Palmer, the man who had written the early proposal for an observatory and the document published early in 1882. Palmer was one of de Burgh's few admirers, but he was seen as a knowledgeable authority on this, and invited by the commission to write a report. He praised the, this is Henry Spencer Palmer. He was a very good astronomer, a member of the Corps of Engineers, but later went to work privately for the Japanese government. The commission was impressed by Palmer's presentation, and also by de Burgh. I must be said that de Burgh was a very formidable man to meet on any basis. He could persuade almost anybody of his position, and did. He had at least four commissions of inquiry during his 24 years, and in all cases he came out. Admittedly, one of them was aborted because the other members refused to continue with him, but he never failed in committees of inquiry. Well, the commissions of inquiry's report came out, and to the dismay of the governor, I think, not only suggested that the observatory be not continued, but said the observatory was badly treated and should be extended, both in terms of financial support. Almost a doubling of the annual budget was recommended by the commission, and in terms of staff, two additional staff being recommended. A chief assistant, who would be immediately under de Burgh and senior to the existing first assistant, and an assistant meteorologist. Well, one might have thought with the addition of these, and this was approved reluctantly by the governor, but the colonial office gave the okay to this, said this is a good idea, we want to have a proper observatory, this is what has to be done. So a chief assistant was found, and a person of one John Isaac Plummer. Plummer was an astronomer, essentially no experience in meteorology. And the only problems with the observatory, according to the local people means the colonial press, was with meteorology. There were never any complaints about the time ball. Plummer was an astronomer. And of course, de Burgh was instrumental, although it's rather confused, but he was instrumental in having him appointed. They didn't get on very well, however. Plummer was 8 years older than de Burgh, and didn't take kindly to being instructed to clean the dirty time ball. Now, we have little to say about Plummer and meteorology, but he did publish a pamphlet after de Burgh had left in 1910 on the origin of typhoons. This is an eccentric publication, to put it mildly. It did not contain the imprimatur of the observatory, and there is no mention. De Burgh gets some slight mention, but no mention of the then director, Frederick Figg. And no copy of it, it's a scarce document, no copy of it was to be found in the observatory's library, which survived almost unscathed the Japanese occupation. Partly, one must imagine, from embarrassment, because Plummer argued that whereas most people thought typhoons originated over hot spots in the ocean, no, Plummer said, they originated over land. Well, that's the end of our digression on Plummer and typhoons. The second appointment was of an assistant meteorologist. And in the job description for that post, he included the notorious sentence, well known now, "It is important that I should have somebody living with me who would be at my beck and call any hour of the day or night." Well, he got that because, of course, he had somebody in mind for the job, to wit, his sister Anna. It was not a straightforward appointment. There was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing in London as to Anna's qualifications, females were appointed to civil service jobs at that time, anyway. But anyway, Anna did arrive, stayed in the observatory for 25 years, and made a very useful contribution. If anybody ever comes across a photograph of Anna, I would very much appreciate it. There seems to be no sign of her in those 25 years. She was a member of the Ladies' Recreation Club. She had some contact with Governor Nathan, You'd have to read, go in the book to see that. And the film rights are available. And her main job was going out to boats and liners in the harbor to collect information from ships' logs on storms and collect the logs herself. She was known as Typhoon Annie locally, but we will have to pass on. She was a very interesting person, Anna de Werck. Where are we now? There were many other events, of course. I will only mention one of them, the notorious Jesuit conspiracy. In 1898, the Americans took over the Philippines, and de Werck immediately wrote to the relevant authorities, the War Office in Washington, asking them to stop all signals from the Manila Observatory reaching Hong Kong. The Americans did this. Not only that, they stopped the Manila Observatory from sending signals anywhere, including Shanghai. Of course, when word of this got to Hong Kong and to Shanghai, the maritime community were outraged because they always valued the signals from Manila. He was, of course, chastised, the only second chastisement he ever had in his 24 years, by the government for so improperly acting. And the government, of course, very soon asked the Americans to restore the signals, which they did. That was, he wrote a lot about alleging a Jesuit conspiracy to take over science in the world and things like that. There were other events, but let's get on to the final and defining event in his career. On the morning of the 18th of September, a storm signal went up at 8 o'clock. The storm maximum was at 10 o'clock, and it was all over at 11 o'clock. 11 winds were recorded at the peak of the storm, and vast damage was done. As we see, 10,000 were lost, it's reckoned. The whole boat population in the harbor, they also did not have any warning for this storm, including the Anglican Bishop of Hong Kong, who was out on his boat on a boat in Mirs Bay, was also lost, and his body never found in that event. Well, of course, again, there was howls of outrage in the press for this failure to raise a signal, and another commission of inquiry. This committee of inquiry heard various reports from everybody. The important item was that the storm was extremely small extent. It was very violent, but a very small diameter. And in fact, Macau was almost untouched by the storm. Only force 1 winds were recorded in Macau when that storm came across. So nobody had detected the storm on the way. However, there was a French corvette or something sunk here, and several French mariners lost. And the French consul claimed that indeed warning had been received from the Sijiawe Observatory about this storm. There was a lot of controversy about this. But of course, everybody knew, even if there was some message from Sijiawe, that de Werck ignored it anyway. But in fact, he was not at fault here again, because here's synoptic charts from the Sijiawe Observatory. The storm was on the last day here, the 18th. These charts had just begun to be produced the previous summer in Sijiawe. It would be many years before Hong Kong Observatory would be in a position to produce charts like this. So we can see on the 16th, there is indeed a significant depression in the northern Philippines. The next day, no evidence, there's still something there, but no evidence that it's headed towards Hong Kong. And on the morning of the storm, on the 18th, the whole business has dissipated. These were the, in other words, there's another one. These were the charts that the French consul alleged warned Hong Kong of the imminence of the storm. It's not plausible, I must say. There was no valid warning. And the Committee of Inquiry, to the great disgust, I think, of the governor and the local press, found that there was no negligence in the observatory on the storm. It simply came unannounced. It was a very small dimensions and could not have been warned of earlier. The governor, as I said, was not happy with, so he sent the whole stuff to the Royal Society in London, to the Astronomer Royal, who came back with exactly the same message as the Committee of Inquiry. There was no negligence in the observatory. The storm could not have been foreseen. So again, Dobberk was exonerated. This was his fourth or fifth committee of inquiry, and he was never found at fault in any of those. The actual track of the storm, of course, could be mapped out later. That there, it came across, but it went right through the Bashi Channel across this Bataan Island, where it did some damage and was recorded. But unfortunately, there was no telegraphic communication between Bataan and the rest of the Philippines at that time. So the message never got around. It was seen by one or two ships on the Manila-Shanghai route, and one coming down on the following morning. But that's how it got across, totally undetected by any observatory like that there. Partly because of its very small extent. It was more like a tornado than a typhoon. Well, that was, well, he was exonerated, but there was a general feeling that he wasn't the best man in the position. And an earlier quotation I gave from the acting governor impressed this. The following year, he was 55 years of age, the youngest age at which he could retire on full pension, and he did indeed leave in 1907. Was he encouraged to go? The Jesuits certainly claim he was kicked out, but I've not seen explicit suggestions that he should go. But there is an important letter to him in the early 1907, which is not in the files and would very likely throw light on that. Anyway, he left. I suppose he was fed up with meteorology. He was never interested in meteorology, really. He wanted to do astronomy. I have not spoken at length about his surreptitious efforts to pursue astronomy throughout his 24 years. But he did live another 25 years and worked on his own private observatory in Surrey, and published quite a bit on double stars and meteors. That was the end of the day for Dr. Dobberk. Now, it would be remiss of me just to abandon it there. Let me just point out that his successor as director was this Frederick George Figg. Figg smoothed things over. He went to Manila at the earliest possible opportunity, and although he was not friendly with the people in Shanghai. Figg had been with Dobberk from day one. They arrived on the same boat in 1883, but he was a very self-effacing man. He never contradicted his boss, even though he often had good grounds for doing so, because Dobberk did not always treat him kindly. But Figg was, and he became an expert on typhoons. He was the, as they used to say in the paper, the typhoonologist at the observatory in the later years. Dobberk was more interested in astronomy or other things like that. So I just want to give some credit to Frederick George Figg, the second director of the observatory. Thank you.
Which takes us to the Q&A session. Would you? Yeah. So if anybody has a question for Professor McEwen, please raise your hand, wait for the microphone, and state your name, please. I'll kick off by asking, Professor, you must have trawled through tons of archives during your research. I just wonder, did you come to any surprising conclusion about the general state of the colonial administration of Hong Kong back then in the late 19th century?
Excuse me. I have to hold it, do I?
There we go.
Okay. Dobberk was an outlier. I think the colonial administration was as you would have expected it to have been. It was subservient to the maritime interests, the commercial interests. It was not forward-looking. It was not certainly not scientific. I did not mention that Dobberk was an excellent scientist. You could not fault him on his science. He was very sensitive to accuracy of measurement and things like that. It was his simple personality and his, for unexplained, I don't know why he was so hostile to the Jesuits that caused a lot of the trouble, his trouble, his problems. A very good question indeed. I would have thought that 9 years in the Queen's first colony would have acclimatized him to the mores and manners of colonial society, but that seemed not to be the case. As I said, he arrived here directly from there. In the west of Ireland, of course, he was a free agent. He could do what he liked. It was a private observatory. He was expected to turn up for dinner occasionally and entertain people that, and he did publish quite a bit on astronomy there, but he could have done what as he pleased. It was a sinecure almost.
There's no record of
his engagement
with priests?
No, I can find nothing about him in... there was a priest who wrote two books, actually, and praised him, a local canon, who wrote a history of Sligo, and another, and mentions Dobbierk on at least two occasions, favorably, and his sister Anna, who visited him for a year in Imercree. So no, there's no evidence of hostility. Oh, yes, but there is another aspect which I did not. Should I go? When Dobbierk arrived here, he had with him his housekeeper, Miss Eliza de Salis. He requested that she be appointed second secretary in the observatory within 4 months of his arrival. This was denied by the governor and the executive council because it was pointed out to him that his relations with his housekeeper were notoriously not of an entirely scientific nature. So, yes, there was that relationship with Mrs. de Salis, and could that have been a cause of clerical friction? I don't know.
But this Jesuit conspiracy to take over the sciences all over the world that you alluded to during your speech, was that a commonly held view back then?
I don't think so. Certainly as far as colonial authorities here were concerned, they held the Jesuits both at Xujiahui and Manila in the highest regard. And I didn't see any, articles were written up in the local newspapers on those two observatories only in favorable terms. They never criticized the Jesuits. Yes, I don't see, and there were, well, I saw no evidence of anti-Jesuit feeling elsewhere.
It was just him. Any other questions from the audience?
Hello, I'm George Russell. Thanks for coming. This is really interesting. What was the perception of forecasting in those days? I mean, obviously the chance of a devastating storm, but what was the public perception? Was it like today when we expect them to get it right, that the weekend's going to be fine, that kind of thing, or was it just about the dangerous weather?
This is a big question. As I mentioned, when he was initially charged by the London authorities, did not mention forecasting. And forecasting had been in bad favor after the suicide of Fitzroy, a famous meteorologist, although it was beginning to pick up in Britain. But here in Hong Kong, the viewpoint was different. Local weather forecasts were not... Hong Kong is not a difficult place to forecast tomorrow's weather from. You know, it's usually more or less like today or a little bit different or something like that. Forecasts like that were not of great interest. The only forecasting that really was important was that of storms. And they thought... the expectations were too high in some cases, of course, because the amount of telegraphic information available was very slight in those early days. A lot of forecasting was done on the basis of archived paths, archived trajectories of previous storms. So they would sort of look at those and see what's likely to happen in this one here. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
But was it the norm to appoint astrologists?
Oh, yes,
to run observatories back then.
Yes, it was. Astronomy and meteorology were considered bedfellows at the time. There was no anomaly in an astronomer being appointed, but just that...
Does this saga in any way give us clues about the politicization of, say, the climate debate that's going on now?
I think not, but I cannot see.
Well, was it politicized? You're saying it was a personality, but was it a political faction sort of thing that people...
It was commercial rather than political. I mean, it's the people who own go-downs and insurance companies and shipping interests. They were the people who were concerned with the weather. It's nothing to do with the people in the street. I mean, the man in the street was hardly a factor in this stuff.
Well, did the shipping lines have their own intelligence service?
Apparently not. And in fact, a remarkable thing is how little the Royal Navy contributed, either to the setting up of the observatory or to later storm warnings and that. There is almost no mention of the Royal Navy in this context, although they were here, of course, and there was always an admiral of the station.
Right, we have a question from the gentleman in front.
With the microphone.
I'm Martin Sauer. Could you give us an idea of what technology was available then? I mean, this was the end of the Victorian age, I guess. There was quite some sophisticated advances.
Well, those thermometers, of course, mercury and glass thermometer would be the standard one. Barometers, both mercury barometers and aneroid barometers, they were well developed at the stage and could be calibrated. They had cross-calibration. That anemometers for measuring the wind, they were not so good and not so well calibrated. They often blew away, for one thing. And even when they were functional, there was some error involved. It took quite a bit of time to sort out. And different models of anemometer were used. Relative humidity was another slightly more difficult, but it wasn't a serious problem. Anemometers, I think, wind speeds were the least accurately measured of the parameters at that time, I think. The pressure was measured to a hundredth of an inch, according to de Burgh, of course. He claimed the Manila fathers only measured it to a 50th of an inch. A tenth of an inch was good enough for any purposes, almost, but no.
And the gentleman in the...
It's a lady there.
Dominic Nisbet, I've got a non-technical question. What happened to his sister?
What happened to what? The sister?
His sister.
Oh, yes. Her initial appointment was subject to de Burgh remaining as director of the observatory. But when he retired, she was substantiated, tenured in the position, and she stayed there until 1915. Still in the same position as assistant meteorologist, and she went home on the Trans-Siberian in the middle of the Great War. The only message after that is she was in Italy somewhere writing about her pension. I can find nothing else about her. She has a grand nephew still alive in Copenhagen, but he also knows nothing more about her. Yeah.
That lady over there?
Just a quick question. I'm curious, when you mentioned telegraphic signals, are they actually observation or forecast?
Oh, observations. Observations transmitted by telegraph.
So basically people are looking at what people have observed and predict what's going on, or?
No, you take the data from the different stations and try and get a picture of the overall situation, meteorological situation at a given time. It would be nice if you could do it instantaneously, but you couldn't. So it's just, they send the temperature, the pressure, and the wind speed, that's all that was necessary by telegraphic. The telegraph companies were very generous in transmitting this data, because at commercial rates it would have been very prohibitively expensive from all the stations that it was sent.
Yeah. And the lady over there.
Hi, I'm Una Toner. I just have a question about the Jesuits. How on earth did they end up in Shanghai doing meteorological work in the first place?
Oh, well, they opened a high school, of course. When they returned, after the suppression of the Jesuits was lifted, they returned to China, to Shanghai, opened a high school, and from there on, these priests were, educated. They had been, some of them had been at Stonyhurst in England, and others had been in the United States in the observatory. Man in Manila had been spent 2 years in a university in the United States, in Baltimore, Johns Hopkins, maybe somewhere like that. So, they were. That was
Clara Ivana, I have a question for the years after de Burgh had left. I guess at that point they did collect the information from all over the region. Did that already help them with the forecasting, or did it take many more years and a lot more technology to really establish a system of forecasting, such as?
You're asking me, is that the case? Yes, it certainly was the case. It was progressive. And of course, after a wireless telegraphy came in around 1910, somewhere around then they could get information from ships and instantaneous information from many places by wireless, and that transformed meteorology. just as the original line telegraphs had transformed it, then wireless telegraphy made they could construct those synoptic charts every day. There was no problem. Loads of data coming in.
Time for one more question? If not, then please join me in thanking Professor McEwen again for this most fascinating talk. And also, just very quickly, I've got two other events this week. I think we've got spaces for limited seats for both. The first one, tomorrow, lunch by Dr. Ron Zhongzhe, former senior diplomat from PRC and also now currently vice president of the China Institute of International Studies. He'll talk about the world and Chinese diplomacy in 2013. And then on Wednesday, we have Mark Kito, well-known magazine founder and author based in Shanghai, well, used to be based in Shanghai, and now he's retreated to Mount Mogoshan, where he and his wife run a guest shop and guest house and coffee shop. He's going to talk about how he's going quietly cuckoo on a Chinese mountain. Thank you again, Professor.
And before we forget, there's a...